Thank you for joining us today. Today I have Dr. Donald Carvith, PhD. He is an emeritus professor of sociology and social and political thought and a senior scholar at York University, Toronto, Canada. He is a past director of the Toronto Institute of Psychoanalysis and a past editor-in-chief of the Canadian Journal of Psychoanalysis. He is the author of Guilt, A Contemporary Introduction, 2023, Psychoanalytic Thinking, 2018, and The Still Small Voice, 2013. Dr. Carvith, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Daniel. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, it's good to be with you, too. I came across you from another podcast, and then I found that you have your own YouTube channel, and then I read a couple of your articles, and you write about and have a lot of interests in the things that I am trying to learn more about and I'm very interested in. So I'm really excited to hear from you today.
Great. Looking forward to our conversation too, Daniel.
Yeah, thank you. Can you kind of just, for me and for the people listening who maybe haven't heard of you before, can you give us a little bit of your just general background and what got you interested in what you're interested in?
Sure. Well, my dad was a family doctor, and I always assumed I would be doing medicine like him. The only problem is that on the weekends when he didn't have a nurse, some kid would fall off a bike and split his head open, and I'd be 8 or 10 years upstairs playing, but my dad would call me down to the surgery because he needed someone to clip the stitches. And every time he did that, I passed out. It should have occurred to me that maybe medicine was not my path in life, but it did not until I got into pre-meds at the university. And then I just suddenly realized there's no way I'm going to cut up cadavers. There's no way I'm doing rectal examinations. And I'm full of envy of the kids coming out of the U of T bookstore with big texts in anthropology, psychology, whatever. So I switched to psychology. I thought, well, I won't be a psychoanalyst because I thought you had to be medical to be a psychoanalyst. I'll be second best. I'll be a psychologist. But at U of T in those days, psychology was rats, chimps. If you got lucky, a dog maybe. I quickly dropped out of psychology. At least in anthropology and sociology, they were talking about human beings and their beliefs and their cultures. And that really interested me. But by third year university, I recognized that the great psychoanalyst Eric Fromm was a PhD in sociology and also a psychoanalyst. And then I saw that my philosophy professor was in training to be a psychoanalyst, the first non-medical in Canada. And so I said, okay, I got to get a PhD. I got to get tenure because I wanted to be a professor. And once I did get the tenure, I immediately applied for analytic training, and I graduated in 1985. So I had been teaching at the university since 1970, but in 1985, I graduated as a psychoanalyst, and I continued teaching for a total of 46 years before retirement, and I maintained a small practice. I was so busy at the university, I couldn't see more than two or three analytic patients at a time. But when I graduated in, I think it was 2014 or 15, retired. when I retired, I immediately expanded my practice. And now at age 80, I had a birthday a couple of weeks ago. I'm busier than I've ever been in practice and teaching in the Psychoanalytic Institute. So I'm in private practice, and I was so addicted to teaching after 46 years that I couldn't stop. So I discovered YouTube, and that was my salvation. I think there are about 125 YouTube video lectures up there, and I'm still writing. I did the first book before retirement, and then after retirement I did the second, and then last year I did the third, and I think there's a fourth in process. So that's pretty much where I'm at.
Yeah, thank you. Well, happy birthday.
Oh, thanks a lot.
When it comes to psychoanalysis, so you graduated you said institute in 1985?
1985 was graduation year, yep.
Yeah, that's like the height of behaviorism, huh? What have you seen, what changes have you seen take place in the last 20, 30, 40 years?
You mean within psychoanalysis itself, or?
Within psychoanalysis, but also like the broader culture. Do you think people are more open to psychoanalysis nowadays, or are they still thinking that that's, you know?
There's a mixed answer to that. I mean, one of the reasons I got out of psychology was because of behaviorism and positivism. Sociology had a very, at least in my department, there are two kinds of sociologists. They're either survey number crunching types, or they're more oriented to history and philosophy. And the chairman of my department who hired me was very much a historical sociologist, a humanistic. They read theory, including they read Freud. So I was very lucky in that way. I've always been an anti-positivist. Humanism is coming back. There has been an Erich Fromm revival, Fromm being a humanistic Marxist and psychoanalyst and a humanist. And he was very out of fashion for many years, but there's a real Fromm revival outside of psychoanalysis. I mean, some analysts are interested in Fromm, but a lot of people who are not practicing analysts are interested in Fromm as a social thinker. And so that's very encouraging. Postmodernism is on the wane, thankfully. That obscurantism, I mean, it's still there in the universities where you have to learn how to speak in a way that no one understands. Yeah. Because if people understand you, they take the fact that they can understand you as a sign that you're stupid and not worth understanding. But that is waning. People are learning, again, how to speak in clear sentences and not be ashamed of doing so. There's a lot of there's a revival of interest in psychoanalysis. We're never short of applicants for training. on the other hand, there's a real crisis in psychoanalysis now because all of the social justice warriors, they're wanting to turn psychoanalysis into politics because they're not really interested in psychoanalysis. They're interested in anti-racism, anti-sexism, anti-LGBTQ, and there's great pressure. You can get canceled within psychoanalysis by these political groups if they don't think you're committed enough, if they think you're saying the wrong things. Yeah. I mean, I got fired from one program because I was teaching something that drew on Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, and I was quoting from Huckleberry Finn, and I broke off from the quotation and I said, I am not going to use the N-word, and then I went on. But I got, apparently, saying you're not using the N-word is as bad as using the N-word.
Whoa.
So, I mean, that kind of narrow-minded, stupid, moralistic thinking. I mean, fundamentally, it's very unintelligent. But it's there. The woke ideology. I'm not against woke. I think I've always been woke. I'm a sociologist. How can you be a sociologist and not get to be anti-racist, anti-sex? Okay, so I've always been woke, but I am not a woke authoritarian. So what we see now is authoritarian wokeness. And I'm a Democrat, and I don't like authoritarianism. So psychoanalysis has its problems, but there's still plenty of interest in it. I think things are maybe getting better. A lot of analysts finally got the courage to stand up against authoritarian wokeness. So I'm hopeful.
Yeah. Why do you think that there's been this Erich Fromm revival? Why him?
Well, because I think a lot of genuine leftists coming out of Marxism. I mean, the left has ceased to mean Marxism. Hmm. The left has come to mean identity politics. So a few years ago, there was a distinguished Marxist historian, a black man, teaching at Penn, and he was invited by the Democratic Socialists of America to speak, and pressure was brought, and they canceled his invitation because no one wants to hear from Marxism. they want to hear anti-racism. They don't want to hear Marxism, which is absurd. but anyway, that's the way it got to be. I think a lot of people are fed up with that. A lot of people want there to be a genuine left, not just identity politics left. A genuine left is essentially a humanistic Marxist. No one's interested in the Soviet communism. It's a totalitarian nightmare. Mm-hmm. But that was not Karl Marx. That was Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin and all of those people. I mean, for me, Marxism is a type of sociological analysis. Look at the issues of class and look at the money and look at the economic interests. It's a way of analyzing what's going on in society. Follow the money. You know, even good detective novels say that. Uh-huh. So Eric Fromm is a serious democratic humanistic Marxist, and he injects into Marxism what was missing from it, a psychology. Marxism was absent an adequate psychology. So you get the psychology from psychoanalysis, and you fuse that with humane Marxism, and you get a pretty darn interesting outlook on the world.
That's really interesting. I think you hear a lot of nowadays, a lot of people, especially on the right, they go from, or they equate Marxism with communism with, yeah. And they say, it's never worked. We tried that many times.
Right.
Would you say that you can have like a Marxist view or philosophy or sociology combined with psychology like Eric Fromm and also be, I don't know, libertarian or even Republican or capitalistic? I don't know.
I doubt you could be a Republican, but I don't know. Well, look, there used to be a sane Republican Party made up of classic conservatives, guys like Barry Goldwater. I mean, he was pretty far to the right in some ways, but in other ways, he was a very humane man. I wrote a review of a book called Conservatives Without Conscience. It was supposed to have been written by Barry Goldwater together with John Dean, who was the lawyer who got into trouble during the Watergate, and then he served his time. And anyway, I wrote a review of that book. They were, because Barry Goldwater's classic book was called The Conscience of a Conservative. But towards the end of his life, he's writing a book called Conservatives Without Conscience. He was horrified by the fundamentalist right who took over much of the party. He thought that Republican Party was headed for disaster. He was quite right. It went crazy. So I don't know about a Republican. I'm shocked because frequently I've been interviewed by people who call themselves conservatives, and they see me as quite compatible on some levels with their worldview because I am anti-totalitarian. I'm a Democrat. I don't like the authoritarianism on the left or on the right. Mm-hmm. And I'm horrified by cancel culture, as they are. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that I've got a lot in common with conservatives. On the other hand, I don't like capitalism. I think capitalism takes us to the destruction of the human world. It promotes greed. But look, I'm not for smashing it, because smashing anything is dangerous and usually makes things worse. So I'm for rigorously controlled capitalism. I'm for the old welfare state. I'm for Bernie Sanders. I'm left of Bernie Sanders. I would carry it. I mean, I think the rich should be severely taxed. I'm for income redistribution. I was all in favor of Occupy Wall Street, you know, the 1% versus the 99%. I want to tax the hell out of the 1%. Controlled capitalism. You have to control it, because it is very creative. It is very energetic, and that's its strength. But that energy and creativity is channeled into greed. And incredible, ridiculous accumulation, which should be redistributed. So that's my stance. I'm a democratic socialist.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Talking about the kind of switching gears for a second. Yeah. You're talking about Erich Fromm being a humanist. Would you see Sigmund Freud as a humanist?
Wow, that's an interesting question. Fundamentally, I would say yes, but philosophically quite flawed. You could describe Freud's overall theory as a psycho-biology. The mythical image of the centaur, the mythical creature that has the head and torso of a man and the body of a horse. That's a pretty good image of Freud's thinking. The head and the torso are what he called the ego, reason, the superego, morality. That's the human half, but it's tied to the horse, which is the Freudian id, which for Freud were the drives or the instincts, which ultimately he saw as grounded in the body. The passions of sex and aggression, he thought, bubble up from the body. Well, they don't. That's a mistake. Even human sexuality, unlike animal sexuality, mostly starts in the head, not in the gonads. The higher up you go, you start with the invertebrates, and then you know the vertebrates, and then come up to the all the way up to the primates and then up to man. At the higher up you go, the more sexuality is controlled by learning as opposed to automatic mechanisms. By the time you get to man, it's like 99% learning, and it's shot through with imagery. It's a story. It's highly symbolic. So Freud is really wrong to think of both sexuality and aggression as fundamentally biologically grounded. That's a mistake. Subsequent schools of psychoanalysis have broken free. So I don't think humanistic, that part of Freud which goes biological, it's kind of not humanistic. To me, I associate humanism with existentialism. I associate it with the recognition and with the Abrahamic religions, which are existentialist. People often forget. They think existentialism is some weird ideology on the French bank in Paris of Jean-Paul Sartre. Well, that was one brand, but all of the Abrahamic religions believe human beings are free, have free will. That's why they hold us responsible, and that's why guilt is a part of human existence, because we make choices. So a real humanism is a humanism that recognizes freedom, responsibility, guilt. Freud was not good on that. Freud called free will an illusion. That's a mistake. Free will is not an illusion. He was too much of a determinist. He was too biologically oriented towards the drives. On that, those are real limitations. Like, on the other hand, he was humanistic in the sense that, And he's in a contradiction because he says free will is an illusion and we are determined. And yet he says the aim of his therapy is to set people free from their obsessive compulsions and obsessions and inhibitions and symptoms. So he was humane in that he wanted to help free people from their neurotic problems. But his theory was out of sync with his clinical humanistic aim. So he's a divided figure when it comes to humanism. Eric Fromm breaks out of that and is much more consistently humanistic and existentialist.
Yeah, I was curious because I just recently read Freud and Man's Soul by Bruno Bettelheim.
Oh, Bettelheim, that's a wonderful book.
Yeah, and he makes an argument that maybe not that Freud was a humanist, but that he's much less humanistic in the English translations than he is in German.
Correct.
If
the words, we came up with this word psychoanalysis. If the translation had been done properly, it would be called soul study. And the analyst would be a soul doctor. And I think that is so, that's so much better. It's so much more accurate. But you know, at the same time, Freud himself was a positivist. He was caught up in materialistic, reductionistic kinds of thinking. I mean, he originally wanted to be a physiologist, a professor of physiology. He was a strict Darwinist. He would have used the word soul for psyche, but he was very divided about it. Like, he complained that when he wrote up his case studies, people read them as if they were short stories. And this bothered him because he thought they should read like strict scientific reports with charts and graphs and whatever. But, you know, he was a practicing humanist, but he theoretically was a positivist.
Yeah, I was trying to understand. I've heard it argued that earlier in his career, he was a lot more trying to base himself in pure science and naturalism and biology.
Yes.
But later, as he developed and matured, he let loose a little bit of that and became more became more humanistic, I guess.
Well, the book was 1920, Beyond the Pleasure Principle, and that's where he introduces the drives of Eros and Thanatos. Eros is broader than sexuality. It's a drive to connect and to integrate. And Thanatos is a drive to literal death, but also to disconnect and disintegrate. And that, especially his idea of a death drive, people haven't really recognized that, and I don't think Freud recognized, that was his break with Darwin. Because a death drive makes absolutely no sense within the Darwinian framework. It's all about survival, right? Right. We're saying we have a natural drive towards death. Well, first of all, that idea is absurd. There is no such thing as a natural drive towards death. Now, here is where Eric Fromm is really interesting. For a long time, I stupidly thought that in writing about biophilia and necrophilia, those are Freud's terms, he's just one of these guys who comes up with new words for what Freud already had said. By biophilia, he meant Eros. Necrophilia, he meant that. No, that was my mistake. There's a huge difference. Biophilia and Freud's Eros are the same. A biologically grounded urge to live and a love of living and wanting to stay alive. And, okay, that's Eros and biophilia. But necrophilia for Fromm is nothing natural, whereas the death drive for Freud, preposterously, Freud thought of it as a natural drive, that everybody has this natural drive towards death. Fromm calls it necrophilia, the love of death, but for him, that's a perversion. That's a pathology. When the life drive is blocked, people turn to death. But it's not natural. It's an unnatural turn. So that's why Fromm is really superior to Freud in that area. But you're right that at that point in his thinking, 1920, Freud is capitalizing Eros and Thanatos as if they are metaphysical principles or kind of like mythic gods or something. He's doing metaphysics. He's moved. Mm. Yeah, he's trying to break out of his positivistic materialism.
Mm, interesting. Would you say that for Freud, even the concept of mental illness was a metaphor?
No, I wouldn't go that far. I would say that for Donald Karveth, mental illness is nothing more than a metaphor. I'm with Thomas Szasz, the myth of mental illness. You see, the thing is, Szasz really nailed it, and no one has really rebutted Szasz, because what he says is that they want to claim that mental illness has some biochemical, neurochemical imbalance. If they can prove that the mental illness has a neurochemical imbalance, then it's not mental illness anymore. It's a brain disease. So we reserve the word mental illness for human behaviors that we don't like or find weird, but we can't prove that there's anything biologically wrong. So we call it mental illness. As soon as we can prove something has a biological malfunction in it, then it's a physical illness. It's not a mental. Now, mental illness, Szasz's example is that to call a person mentally ill is the same thing as calling our economy sick.
Mm.
It's a metaphor. That's all it is a metaphor. But you have people taking it literally. And you have a whole profession, psychiatry, based on taking this metaphor literally. Psychoanalysis and psychiatry are very different. There's an unfortunate overlap. But, I mean, a lot of the senior training analysts are themselves medical, and they don't look at these things quite the same way as I do. Certainly, when a psychiatrist applies to become a psychoanalyst, I see my task as a training analyst as helping him stop being a psychiatrist. Okay? And because he's converting to psychoanalysis.
Yeah, I think, didn't even Freud basically advise against, like he said that the type of thinking that psychiatry trains you for, or a medical doctor trains you for, is not good for psychoanalysis. Like, you want to, he's like, read literature and poetry and myth and
history.
Yeah.
Exactly. The question of lay analysis, the little book he wrote to defend non-medical people becoming analysts. And he said, yeah, the best background is something like social science, philosophy, the arts, literature.
Yeah,
I think that, you know, we get applicants who want to be analysts, and we put them through these interviews. And I've always said that instead of one of the interviews, we should design a test. And the test would be a famous piece, maybe just a paragraph or two, of really great literature, a paragraph that is just packed with metaphor and allegory, okay? And we should pick one that's pretty obscure, you know, not a common thing. And we should ask the applicant to unpack it and to write a little short essay about what they find in this piece of literature. What is it saying? And let's see if they can have any feel for a metaphor. Let's see if they can listen with the third ear, see beneath the manifest to the latent. Let's test it.
That would be super interesting.
Yeah, because that's what we're interested in. I mean, a guy could come in and he could be a brilliant philosopher and rational and so on, but he might have no feel for how to listen to the latent text.
Yeah.
That's a kind of a talent, which you kind of either have it or you don't. I don't think an 18 or a 17-year-old kid who goes to university and winds up in an English course, I don't think the English courses teach you how to do that. They develop it. They help you develop it. But you've either got it or not. if you have it, the teacher is enthused and encouraging you to expand and apply that way of hearing and understanding, you know. But some people mm-hmm. have a way with metaphor and some people don't. And unfortunately, many years training in medicine, or on, I'm sorry to say, almost as bad, psychology training, it's bad. It teaches you to think concretely. You got to be like in literature or the arts to be helped to think metaphorically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. The reason I asked about if you would think that Freud considered mental illness a metaphor, in that Freudian Man's Soul. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out how much, because I know Bruno Bettelheim was like a true Freudian follower, you know? So yeah. A lot of this, I assume that the writing will only paint the most positive impression of Freud. And I'm trying to figure out, is this what Bruno Bettelheim thought of Freud, or is this really what Freud thought and believed?
Oh, but, that's a very good question. I think that's the Freud Bettelheim wished Freud was.
Yeah, because in there he says that Freud loved to use metaphors, and he says of all the metaphors that Freud used, probably none had more far-reaching consequences than the metaphor of mental illness, and derived from it the metaphor of psychoanalysis as the treatment and cure of mental illness. And then he talks about how it was understood as a metaphor, but then in the United States it became tangible, something akin to a physical existence, like a bodily organ, and that mm-hmm. needed treatment as part of medical science. But I've heard of Thomas Schatz. Is it Thomas? Dr. Schatz.
Thomas Schatz, yeah.
Yeah. I've heard of him, and then I recently read that, and I was thinking, okay, did Freud really see mental illness as a metaphor and he's trying to explain it, or is that just Bruno Bettelheim?
That's Bettelheim.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, he did use the soul. He did know that he was writing about the psyche, but it kind of bothered him. Let's give him credit. For a guy of his time and with his medical training and his interest in physiology, I mean, he was cutting up eels to study the nervous system of eels. I mean, he came a long way away from that reductionism. But he still anchored the psyche, the soul, he still anchored it in the biological. He did not entirely free it. I don't think he understood mental illness purely as a metaphor. I mean, for many years, I can give you a definitive answer. He broke out of psychiatry insofar as in the early 1900s, he was giving psychological explanations of obsessive compulsive behavior. He was giving psychological explanations even of schizophrenia. But there was one condition that it took him to 1917 to start to talk about psychological mechanisms in depression. Before 1917, he thought that depression had a biochemical, biological basis. Why did he think that? Because he himself suffered from depression. He didn't want to see what he suffered from as a psychological rather than a physically based condition. And he was treating his depression with a drug, cocaine. And because he thought that because cocaine lifted depression, the depression must be, if a chemical will cure depression, the condition must be chemical. In 1917, he breaks out of that and begins to understand the psychic mechanisms in depression. So, you know, when a baby duckling breaks out of the egg, for a while, it walks around with big pieces of the eggshell stuck to its back. I'm giving you a metaphor for Freud.
Yeah, I like that.
He broke out of positivism, but he had big chunks of it still stuck to him.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. I also have recently been looking into Pfister. Can't think of his first name right now. Oscar Pfister. There we go. And he referred to Freud. Yeah, Swiss pastor.
Yeah.
He referred to Freud as a Christian.
Yeah, but he was joking. No,
what'd you say?
what he said is anyone who has done as much to relieve the suffering of humanity as you have is a Christian, whether he knows it or not. Of course, that's nonsense. I mean, lots of people are interested in relieving human suffering. That doesn't make them a Christian. It makes them a decent human being. It doesn't make them a Christian, right? You know, that was he was provoking Freud, and that would provoke Freud. He would hate to that. That would drive him crazy.
Yeah.
No, Freud was no Christian. Freud had contempt for Christianity. Freud mocked the Christian love command.
There's so Freud wrote, I think it's the Future of an Illusion. And then Pfister responded with The Illusion of a Future.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in that, Pfister talked a little bit about how Jesus, he wouldn't call Jesus like the first psychoanalyst, especially in any Freudian sense. But if there was some psychoanalysis being done, Jesus was pointing the way.
Guess who did call Jesus the first psychoanalyst?
Who?
Me. I had an online dialogue, and actually Jakob Lusinski is a Jungian analyst in Berlin. He conducts a podcast called Psychology and the Cross, and he's just come out with a book called C.G. Jung, Face to Face with Christianity, and Jung was no Christian, although Jakob thinks he was. Sean McGrath is a Canadian theologian, and Jakob McGrath and I have a dialogue, and that dialogue it's online, but it's contained in this book that is now out, C.G. Jung, Face to Face with Christianity. In fact, Jakob interviewed me last week. We're going to put that up soon on my website. But what was the point? We were talking about
Jesus Freud as the first psychoanalyst.
Oh, Pfister and the Illusion of the Future. They had a very interesting dialogue. But no, Freud was an anti-Christian.
But you said that you called Jesus the first psychoanalyst?
I believe he was. Look, why dost thou protest the speck in your neighbor's eye when you have a beam in yours? Says Jesus. That's projection. That's the theory of projection right there. I think the psychological wisdom built into Christianity is outstanding. I mean... and I think that Christians, many Christian writers, have a deeper understanding of what's involved in psychological cure than psychoanalysts do. I mean, speaking personally, I deeply value my psychoanalytic training, and I deeply value psychoanalytic theory. And when I first meet a patient who's in trouble, all of that knowledge is very useful. I know how to prepare people for healing, much better at it than priests or pastoral people. They don't have enough training. They're headed in the right direction, but they don't have... They should have full psychoanalytic training and then the pastoral on top of that. We know why people should lie down on a couch. We know why they should lie down on the couch three or four times a week. We know what happens when they do. And we understand the mechanisms involved in symptom formation and all of that. And that allows a therapeutic process to begin and take place. But the ultimate cure depends on the patient getting to the point where he understands all of this, and now he has to find the courage to make a change. And he has to start taking responsibility for his life. Now, as a Christian, I also know that it's not just getting the patient to that point. There is something that goes on, and analysts know something about this. There's something that goes on between the analyst and the patient. And the analysts don't write about this properly because they don't want to sound moralistic. But for the analytic cure to take place, the analyst has to have reached a point of personal authenticity. He has to have reached his true self. He has to have grown in an essentially spiritual way, whatever form it may take in his life. But and because he's reached a considerable degree, and no one is perfect, and you can't be perfect. Of course, we're all flawed, and we all remain sinners. I mean, I say the Jesus prayer repetitively: "Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner." I say this all the time now because I am a sinner, and I know that I have to be continually reminding myself that I am and have been a sinner. I need to humble myself this way, you know. So there's no perfect cure, of course. But if to the extent that the analyst has reached authenticity and truth, then there's something that can happen in the dialogue with the person who sees me 4 days a week. I'm infectious. Look, really sick people who are demon-possessed, basically, I'm speaking metaphorically, but there are people who have too much evil in them. And that's infectious. And they contaminate people around them. Okay, so the same thing works on the other side. People who have a lot of goodness and truth in them are also infectious. Mm-hmm. And they infect people positively. So, you know, there are certain people who... We could say that a person is a kind of a natural. Some people are natural healers. They've got some ability to affect people positively. They may have no training in psychology, psychoanalysis. They may have no training at all. They just might be. Well, one of the things that I love about the Greek and Russian Orthodox Christianity is they believe in the holy fool. The holy fool. The holy fool might be retarded, but good. Hmm. And his goodness puts the brilliant intellectuals to shame. So I see, if you ask me, I used to be troubled by the question, do I believe in God? And I gave all kinds of fancy theological answers. Now, if someone says, do you believe in God? I say, I believe that God is good. And goodness is God. I'm not worried about postulates of another world. I don't care about the supernatural. I don't see God as supernatural. I see God as goodness. It simplifies things greatly. Yeah. I believe in that. And St. Paul says... He says, those who have not love know not God. Because he says, because God is love, he says. That I'm taking literally. Mm. God is love. And therefore I believe in God because I believe in love.
Mm.
Okay, that's my simple theology. It's taken me to 80 years to get here, to this.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess in that way, some people would define a Christian as somebody who, yeah, is loving and tries to strive toward truth and alleviate suffering. And that's, if someone who does that, they're imitating Christ and they're a Christian. How would you define a Christian?
Well, you could add on a lot of that. You could expand and add on a bunch of other qualifiers, but I think that's the essence of it, because that I think that's essentially correct. Many people who call themselves Christians and are called Christians are not that.
Mm-hmm.
They're not good. Mm-hmm. I have many friends who are Jewish, who are good. So although they're Jews, and by that definition, they're Christians. Mm. There are all kinds of atheists who have contempt for Christianity and any form of religion, but they're good. Therefore, they're Christian. I mean, if you use that definition, you come up with a lot of kind of paradoxes. A lot of people you ordinarily and who don't think of themselves as Christian are going to be Christian by that definition. But I think it's a pretty good. Don't listen to what I say. Watch what I do. Mm. If people are acting like Christians, then why not call them Christians? Well, they don't want to be called Christians. They want to be called Muslims or Buddhists or whatever. But I think fundamentally all of those labels don't really matter. What matters is the way the person, do they have a heart? I would say, do they have a conscience? You see, my work for the last 20 years has been trying to persuade psychoanalysts to reverse the error Freud made in 1923 when he stopped talking about conscience as a separate function and he merged it into superego. And that's a huge mistake because the superego is like the law. And as we know, often the law is an ass. we need a conscience to critique the law. And Freud merged conscience into superego. Big mistake. I'm pleading with psychoanalysts to separate out a conscience separate from the superego. Conscience is Christ. And what did Christ do? He attacked religion. An evangelical in the U.S., I forget his name at the moment, but he wrote a book called Christianity is Not a Religion. I agree with him. It's a way of being in the world. It's an ethic. It's a way of life. But they made a religion of it. And of course, Christ attacked the religion of his time and they crucified him for it.
Okay. So a few things. When you said that Christ is conscience, right before you said that, I was thinking of the example where Christ said the man was not made for the, man was not made for the Sabbath, but Sabbath was made for man.
Correct.
The law, God, Old Testament God, you know, established the Sabbath and keep it no matter what.
Yeah,
and maybe that's super ego, but then Christ is conscience, and conscience is able to critique the law.
Exactly.
That's what you're saying? Okay.
I'm saying that, but I have to immediately qualify because we don't want to be anti-Semitic. Old Testament, New Testament, it's too reductionistic. That voice of conscience is there in the Old Testament, and the voice of the superego is there in the New Testament. It doesn't line up. You could say Christ is there in the Old Testament, and the strict law is also there in the New Testament. So that has to be sorted out, right?
Yeah,
because we don't want to line things up in an anti-Semitic way. So there's this wonderful paper by C.G. Jung that I only learned about through my friend Jakob Lusensky. 1958, Jung wrote an essay called A Psychological View of Conscience. And he, in 1958, he nailed what I've been working on since the 90s. He clearly distinguishes conscience from superego. And he points out that for in older centuries, the voice of conscience was thought of as the vox dei, the voice of God. And I think that's what it is. I think the voice of conscience is. That's why in the still small voice, I opened with a passage from Kings. And then came the thunder, but God was not in the thunder. And then came the rain, but God was not in the rain. And then came the fire, but God was not in the fire. Then came a still small voice, .. Okay. So God is in the still small voice of conscience. It's persistent. It doesn't berate or humiliate you the way the superego does, but it calls you to account. Don, you're on the wrong path. Come back, Don. Turn around, Don. And like the father of the prodigal son, he welcomes you home. Superego just wants to beat the hell out of you. You know, but conscience wants you to come home. And man, do you ever feel better when you come home? And in fact, it's my argument that that is the only cure. The only cure. Your superego will persecute you because the superego is the devil. And it will persecute you and keep you in hell forever until you turn around and align your life with your conscience. And then you will be free. And then you can face death. Death, where is thy sting? If I'm in peace with my conscience, I can face death.
I think, I'm trying to remember which, I read through some of your work, and one, you were delineating these two, this concept, and you said, I think the example was conscience. So little children, they split mother, and conscience is like the nurturing mother, and superego is maybe the harsh, critical mother, and they... Did you write something like that?
Yeah. This is Melanie Klein. Freud didn't think we got a superego until age 5 or 6 at the end of the Oedipus complex. But Klein says, no, we have it in the first year of life. The child is splitting. And so he's dividing the mother into the good breast and the bad breast. And no mother can avoid being the bad breast because no mother can be completely... she's going to have to delay a few seconds, which to an infant might seem like an eternity. So why are you not delivering the good? Well, you're an evil torturer, okay? Mm. I mean, Klein herself said, and Bion echoed it, the absent good breast is experienced as a bad attacking breast. Mm. Okay, so no one can come out of infancy without forming an image of a bad attacking breast. But kids who are badly mothered will have a hell of a lot of that persecutory bad object persecutor, which is the basis of the superego. The basis of the conscience is the good breast that arrives and soothes and rescues, and I would say is our salvation. It's the infant is experiencing the arrival of the good breast as salvation from terrible pain in his gut and torture, you know, salvation. So there's the basis of conscience, good breast. There's the basis of superego, persecuting breast.
Is that in a way also splitting? Like we're taking the superego and we're splitting it into good and bad.
Yes, because it is splitting, because that's what people do in the first year of life. We're trying to describe psychological development. And as Mrs. Klein explains, the child must learn how to split. That's one of the most fundamental pieces of learning. It's essential. She points out that the child who can't split will remain psychotic. Because what is psychosis? That which I think is good is always going bad. And I'm paranoid as hell because I can't trust the goodness because it's always going bad. And the bad is always going good. So I can't even trust my judgment that someone is all bad because sometimes they become good. So I can't sort the world out into good and bad. Mm-hmm. I'm psychotic. That leads to a total confusion. Okay? So in order to have any kind of psychological order, you have to learn how to split. Now, of course, that is a falsification. Things are not either all bad or all good. But you need to get into that and learn how to do that first. And of course, we still, as adults, we've discovered that there are elements of the paranoid schizoid splitting world which are necessary. You see, we needed to go to war against Hitler. And we need to have soldiers who could pull the trigger. We needed killers. Okay, you can't be a killer unless you enter the paranoid schizoid position. You can't be looking at some soldier and saying, oh, he was once a good little boy, but unfortunately I have to kill him. No. In order to kill him, you have to blind yourself. I mean, people say Hitler was a monster, but he was very kind to dogs. Well, I don't care whether he was kind to dogs. I'm going to put a bullet in his head. But in order to be able to do that, I have to split. Okay, so there is adaptive splitting and there is maladaptive splitting. We all have to move on to the reparative position where we see people whole and we see ourselves whole. But that has pathology too. You can wind up one of these liberals, small L liberals, who sees every side of every question and he's stuck on the fence. He can't make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he's got to come off the fence, which means moving a bit towards the paranoid skiz. You want to be able to distinguish the edible from the poisonous berries, you know? So it's complicated. But back to your question, yes, it is splitting to talk about conscience versus superego. But I'm trying to mitigate that by saying, lately in what I'm writing, I'm saying sometimes the superego overlaps with the conscience, like a Venn diagram, two circles, but there's that area of overlap, right? Uh-huh. Okay, so my conscience is saying, do unto others as you would have them do. And I go to church on Sunday, and they're saying that at church.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm getting that from the superego at church, but it's already there in my heart. And that's a blessed place to be. When your superego overlaps with your conscience, that is a place of salvation for sure.
Mm. That's cool. I like that.
Yeah.
What got you down the pathway of writing on conscience and guilt?
My own personal struggle. As a young man, I was raised in the Anglican Church, but I lost it when I discovered girls and masturbation. And when I discovered Bertrand Russell's Why I Am Not a Christian in my dad's library. All my heroes became the great atheists of the West: Friedrich Nietzsche, Karl Marx, Sigmund Freud, Jean-Paul Sartre. And at the university, my university lectern was my pulpit. And from that pulpit, I preached the gospel of atheism. Hmm. And if a little Christian girl from a small town up north ran crying from my lecture, it was a notch on my gun.
Hmm.
Grow up, kid. This is the university. Hardball. We play hardball here. You know, I mean, I was arrogant. Oh, I must tell you the story of the nun, though. There was an Anglican nun, black woman. She was in my class one year, and I'm busy preaching my atheistic bullshit, and she's looking at me, and of course she's not at all buying what I'm saying, but she has love in her eyes. She's a Christian nun. She saw my goodness behind my badness. She saw it, and I felt her love. I felt her forgiveness. Now, I think that Freud was enraged by what's the Lutheran priest, the Swiss priest, Pfister.
Calvin?
I think Freud was enraged by Pfister's love for Freud. Pfister loved Freud. And I think it kind of enraged Freud a bit. But he must have liked it because he tolerated Pfister saying things to him that he wouldn't tolerate from anyone else. But this nun sat there in the front row. She admired me. She loved me. She knew I was possessed by a kind of a devil. I think she believed one day I would be cured. And she was right. She was right. I mean, I didn't get to show that to her or say that to her. If she's listening, thank God you were there. You helped. She created some guilt in me. I could see that she was forgiving me. And I did not want to be a good man. I was narcissistic. I was greedy. I was filled with lust. I was a liar. I was a betrayer. I was not a good man. And I hurt people. It wasn't until I was in my 40s and my dad was dying, happened to be in a Catholic hospital because he broke his hip and they took him to the bone hospital, not the heart hospital. There was a do not resuscitate but anyway, they resuscitated him and he was into a coma. And over about 4 weeks, I sat beside his bed while he wasted away. It was April, it was hot. He would throw off the covers and you would see the ribs protruding through the skin And I would look at him, and then I would look up at this crucifix on the wall above his bed in the Catholic hospital. I suddenly understood what the crucifix meant. This is where we're all going. Jesus went there, but your turn's coming, boy. and I'm looking at my dad. It's his turn. He's going there. And that started something in my soul. I shocked my wife one day. We were staying in the country, and I got up and put on a shirt and tie, a tie I put on. And she wakes up, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to church. There's an Anglican church in this little town. It's only a half hour away. Oh, yeah, you're going to church. With your wacky theology of Paul Tillich and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, you're going to this little local church. Oh, yeah, have fun. So I went, and the preacher was a product of the Toronto School of Theology, and he built his whole sermon around Paul Tillich's point that we shouldn't confuse the spirit with the letter. We shouldn't confuse our faith with the Gothic arches and the stained glass windows, you know, and that was the beginning of something. I started going back to church, and I was weeping a lot of the time, because I'd go into the church and they'd be singing the same hymns and the same liturgy, and I was weeping. I was coming home. I was the prodigal son. That's who I was. And they welcomed me home. And then my wife got pregnant, and I'm becoming a father. And I'm scared to death. How am I going to be a father? So I had to go where there were fathers, people I could call father. I came back in my 40s. Yeah.
Wow. And that...
That's why that I write about guilt all the time. People say, why are you always writing about guilt and conscience? Because I didn't have much of a conscience, and I had plenty of guilt, only I didn't know it. It was unconscious guilt.
Has that helped you develop a conscience?
Yes. Yes. Look, it's far from perfect. First of all, I believe we all have a conscience. Even the severe psychopath, even like the serial killer. That's why they get caught. That's why they bury it, though. They learn how to not hear it. I was pretty good. I was no serial killer, but I was a serial seducer. I managed to stifle my conscience. I was good at not hearing it. But I think we all have one. Over the years, analysis, my personal experience as a patient in analysis, and just life experience, has liberated my conscience. There's a lot more work to do. I will die before the work is done. All of us will die before the work is done. None of us are able perfectly to hear our conscience or act in accordance with it. That's why I say, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Of course I'm a sinner, but man, have I improved. I'm a lot better man than I was, and I'm ashamed of the way I was living. I'm ashamed about the hurt that I have caused. And I'm determined every day to do better. It's work. It's hard work.
Yeah.
It isn't easy. Yeah.
Would you say then, Saul on the road to Damascus, that was him being confronted with conscience?
Well, I don't think we know enough about exactly what happened there. St. Paul to be on my couch telling me all about that and bringing me the dreams and giving me the details about what happened. All I know is a radical conversion took place there. I am interested. I see psychoanalytic treatment as seeking to bring about a conversion. But most of my colleagues shrink back with shock because they think I'm talking about something sudden and dramatic, like what happened to Saul when he became Paul. No. Psychoanalysis is in my kind of psychoanalysis, I'll speak for me, not for the profession, but my kind of psychoanalysis is intended to be a very patient, slow conversion. But it's still a conversion, and I describe it in Kleinian terms. If someone comes in and they're living mostly in the paranoid schizoid position, where everything is splitting, there is envy, there is sheer narcissism, omnipotence, magical thinking, all that. If you're living in that world, and over a period of, say, a 10-year analysis, you are moving out of that world into the reparative position where you're actually getting your mind off yourself some of the time, and you're developing some capacity for concern and empathy for others. You're living in a different world if you pass across that great divide. It's a little bit like an exorcism at times. You know, you're trying to help the person free himself from his demons. And you're helping him become a more loving person. Wow, that is a conversion, a slow one.
Yeah. One of the questions I wanted to ask you, so I'm still part of Regent University, which is in Virginia, and they have a faculty like William Hathaway and Mark Yarhouse. They wrote a book together called, I should know this right now, but it is called The Integration of Psychology and Christianity.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And I was going to ask, because if you think of Christianity as religion, I know people who try to integrate religion with psychology. And then I know others who say that it can't be done, but there is a collaboration that can take place. And I was going to ask you what you thought about those two different views. You did earlier say that you could tend to think of Christianity not as a religion, but as a way of life. So right. I could see how you could then integrate that with psychology. But yeah, do you have anything to say about that or your thoughts?
Well, I don't like the word religion because I don't like much of what happens under the name of religion, religious institutions. I distrust organizations. Any person who has a conscience is not a team player. Because if you have a conscience, you're willing to throw the organization under the bus like Julian Assange. Finally, he's free. Finally. But he threw, and Edward Snowden, he threw America under the bus. He threw the American government under the bus because they were violating his conscience. Well, you see, organizations hate people of conscience. And the church is an organization. Church also hates people of conscience. So if by religion we mean church, yeah, I think church often, religion, if we mean church, I don't think that has much to do with conscience. It has an awful lot to do with pressuring people to stifle their conscience out of loyalty to the church. Okay, but let's talk about Christianity not as church, but as spirit. The Christian spirit, Christian spirituality. I think Christian spirituality is totally compatible with psychotherapeutic, psychoanalytic practice. In fact, it's absolutely necessary for psychoanalytic practice. Why call it Christian spirituality? Because that's going to seem to exclude Jews and Muslims. No, I guess we shouldn't call it Christian spirituality. We should call it something else. We should call it human authenticity, or I don't know what we want to call it. I personally find it very much connected with Jesus Christ. But I don't want to say that only followers of Jesus. I think there are people who are in sync with Jesus Christ who maybe never even heard of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
So we're talking about something in the soul that for you and I is symbolized by Jesus. But look, let's talk about it in the language of love. Okay, he who hath not love knoweth not God, for God is love. So what we're talking about is love. What we want to promote are loving people, people capable of love, genuine self-love, love for the authentic self, not the false self idol. And we want to promote the ability of people to love. And it doesn't matter whether they're Christians or Jews or Buddhists or whatever. There's so much false. A lot of Buddhists are fake. They're just worshiping themselves. A lot of Christians are totally fake. Same thing with Muslims. So we should probably stop talking in these languages of Jew, Christian, Muslim. We should stop talking those languages. We should be talking about some other thing called authenticity, truth, and love. Mm. That's what we should be talking about. And psychotherapeutic practice desperately needs that and should be all about cultivating that and communicating it and helping people grow into it.
Didn't Freud say that it was to love and to work? That was the outcome?
Yeah, to love, the enhancing the ability to love and to work. I always wanted to add, and to play and to fight. Love, work, play, fight. But, you know, look, Freud at times was very close. In 1914, he was really close. In that essay on narcissism, 1914, he said, either we learn to love or we will fall ill, for we must fall ill if we cannot love. Now, oops, that was like a slip. He couldn't take it back, but he tried to not talk that way. He tried to shift to the language of illness and health, which is a baloney cover story. It's not about illness. It's about, and then he got that whole thing of defending against the drives, which is a huge distraction. He should have made that 1914 essay the center of psychoanalysis. What is psychoanalysis about? It's about helping people free themselves from narcissism and develop the ability to love. He said it in 1914, then he kind of buried it. I think he sensed that he was close to the Abrahamic religion. It's the religions of love, and he hated religion. And to some extent, I think he was right to hate religion. I mean, certainly Christianity and all of the anti-Semitism had hurt him, hurt his father. I think it was a lost opportunity. To some extent, Jacques Lacan brings it back, but Lacan is so full of crap in so many ways. But at least he does see, the early Lacan sees the human problem as a false self. We fall in love with an image, and we are engaged in idolatry. And the cure is breaking out of that idolatry and replacing the ego image with what he calls the subject. And of course, Jacques Lacan was a Catholic. He wrote a book called Catholicism, and he said the one true religion is Catholicism. And so he said a lot of nonsense, but at times, the Lacanians hate being reminded that Lacan was a Catholic. I mean, they'd like to keep that a secret, but he was, and it shows in his work.
I have a question about, so this is kind of touching on a few things that we've talked about. I wanted to ask specifically, I grew up in an evangelical tradition that holds to like the penal substitutionary theory of atonement, where Jesus Christ was a sacrifice and his sacrifice appeased the wrath of God, so that we could find forgiveness through that, and God would not, we would no longer be at enmity with God. Thinking specifically about that, because there's all kinds of different understandings of the atonement, of Jesus, of God, but thinking specifically about that theory of atonement and what it says psychologically about people who resonate with that theory, I was trying to think about, how would I conceptualize that? And I thought, and I used to think to myself, like, well, why can't God just forgive everybody? And then I started thinking, well, if it's psychologically, if God is like a harsh superego, a harsh superego is not going to just be forgiving, or you're not going to be able to feel self-acceptance from a harsh superego. So then I was, well, what is Jesus? Is Jesus like a scapegoat that then brings about some relief for a momentary period from the superego? Or I don't know. I was just trying to think through that. And I was wondering, in that theory, how would you conceptualize that psychologically speaking? Do you have any thoughts?
Thank you for raising that. And forgive me, please, for being blunt. That way of understanding Christianity is utter nonsense and has to be completely flushed down the toilet. It's ridiculous. It makes God into a narcissist, a touchy, cranky, vindictive, and sadistic old narcissistic man. I mean, he will only forgive when an innocent bleeds. Someone's got to bleed. Somebody hurt my feelings. They broke the covenant. Someone has to bleed. I don't much care who bleeds. Could be an innocent. Could be my own son. I don't care. Someone's got to bleed. No, that's the kind of person that you put away in prison and throw away the key, you know? That's a ridiculous concept of God. God is the father of the prodigal son. God is good. God is love. God is not that. That is a totally false theology. And that somehow we are saved through the blood of an innocent sufferer? No. No, 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 no. That's all wrong. You just have to eliminate that from your thinking. There are aspects of evangelical. I mean, you know, I'm divided on that. I'm a high church Episcopalian, and I love Greek and Russian Orthodoxy. I love the icons. I love the smoke. I love the bells. I love that. But in many ways, I'm an evangelical Christian. I'm trying to help people convert. I'm talking about this. I'm doing YouTube talks about this. I'm a preacher. Let's face it. I was either going to preach behind a lectern at the university, or I was going to enter the ministry. I'm glad I didn't enter the ministry because too many tea parties and socializing and all of that. No way. And now I'm using YouTube in a way to preach. I'm trying to use a secular language because I don't want to lose my psychoanalytic colleagues, most of whom are atheists. So I'm talking not about the Vox Dei. I'm talking about conscience, right? Vox Dei. So I think there's probably a lot of good stuff in your evangelical background. That is very good and that you should treasure. But this element of the sacrificial theology, wow, that should be relegated to an antique store.
Yeah, I guess, well, what I'm asking is, for a very long amount of time, that was a very predominant or prevalent theory.
Yes, it was.
And it resonated with a lot of people. And so I guess one of my question is, what type of person might that resonate with, psychologically speaking? And how would you psychologically conceptualize that?
A sick person. Look, this is the sick. This is the problem of sacrifice and scapegoating. Okay. So nowadays you have all of these social justice warriors, and they are righteous. They are self-righteous. They think they've got God on their side. They think they are representing the good. But the evil racists, the evil sexists, the evil heterosexists, burn them at the stake. Okay. They're all good. Let's cancel the bad. This is splitting. This is projection. This is scapegoating. They escape their own conscience and they escape their own superego by embracing the superego and targeting the others. So it's projection of their own sinfulness, and they drape themselves in the superego, and now their sadism is holy sadism. They're justified in attacking and persecuting and terrorizing. They become terrorists, moral terrorists. My first sickening encounter with this is the founder of the Toronto Psychoanalytic Society, who fortunately was not my analyst, but he was my first supervisor. I didn't know it at the time, but he'd been sleeping with women patients for years. And his sins had been being buried, covered by people, senior people who were protecting him. This is the old story of what happens in the church all the time, right? Anyway, finally, enough women came forward that he had to be, you know, he got kicked out of the society. He lost his medical license. And then the society was traumatized because many people had been analyzed by him and many people had been supervised by him. I had been supervised him. I happened to really dislike him. And it turned out I was absolutely right to dislike him. But anyway, we had town hall meetings to try to recover as a group from this fall of the father figure, right? But I was completely disgusted because there were people there who were engaging in an orgy of sadistic condemnation of this man. And their sadism was so disgusting, I thought that was worse than what he did. And even to this day in our society, we can't say anything good about him. This is like the splitting of organizations, or it's like what happened with Jean Vanier. Do you know who Jean Vanier is? No. Okay. So he was the son of one of the Canadian governors general. We still symbolically have the Queen in Canada, and the Queen's representative is called the governor general. And this was a very distinguished man from an old Quebecois family. And his son, Jean, went into the Navy, became a Navy commander. And then on retirement, this is a deeply Catholic old Montreal family. On retirement, he founded the L'Arche communities, which means the Ark. All around the world, he established these communities for handicapped and handicapped people, and university students would spend their summers or take a year off and work in these communities in Canada, in France, in the United States, all over. And these were celebrated, the work that he was doing. And so when he was old, everyone was convinced that shortly after he died, he would be sainted by the Roman Catholic Church. It was almost a sure thing, right? But about a year before that happened, it came out that he had been sexually abusing certain women. I don't think it was the handicapped. It was people who worked in these places, women that he was seducing, okay? Well, suddenly he's all bad. Suddenly he's a devil. There was a CBC radio program, and everyone talking about this, they were just condemning him. It was a phone-in show. I phoned in. I said, what's going on? He did these bad things, but he was also a wonderful man. No one's mentioning any of the good that he did. It's the same thing in the Toronto Psychoanalytic Society. You can't say anything good about this former founder of the society. He wrote brilliant papers. He did good things. He did terrible things. But he did good things. You see, it's so hard for us to not split.
Yeah. And then I think it's common that then for someone who's done something like that, if you, let's say that he was still alive and he was still, that didn't come out like a year before he died. But let's say that that came out, 20 years before he died, and he still had 20 years of doing good things. I think there are people that then say, well, if I talk good about him or give him a platform, I am then supporting him and I am adding further hurt to the victims, or I'm giving him more opportunities to continue hurting people or something like that.
No, that's wrong. Because as a Christian, if you're speaking as a Christian, we have to believe in the possibility of personal atonement and confession and change. It's not just enough to confess. You have to make reparation. Hmm. You have to devote yourself and demonstrate authentic change through your actions. But I mean, I believe that therapists who lose their licenses to practice because they're become sexually involved with their patients sometimes, it's not, mm-hmm. not that rare, they should be given the opportunity for rehabilitation. They should be required to go back into analysis. Their work should be for 5 years or something. And then if they resume their work, they should be supervised carefully for another 5 years. Mm-hmm. We as Christians, we have to believe in the possibility of rehabilitation. And as psychoanalysts, of course, we believe in the possibility of rehabilitation. People come to us because they want to change.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. That's a good point. I think that this is a good stopping place, if that's okay with you. And I will link your YouTube channel in my description and your books and your website.